goodness, it's noon. It is February 20th, Thursday. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. What's the weather like out there? I've been in studio since like the crack of dawn, so I have no idea whether it's. I think it's nice out there.
I think it's nice.
Is it nice? All right, that's good.
Anticipate
the black
ice.
Walk on ice.
Other than
that, but who was walking on black ice last night was Michael Bloomberg. He has now emerged behind the $62 billion of wealth, the money moat of $600 million in ads, and the staff that he's buying all over the country. And Michael Bloomberg performed. All right, Ken, how would you describe it?
Well, what
I can't
say,
swear. I want to be nice here.
What
he
I would say is that it was like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And
like the Wizard
Elizabeth
of Oz.
Warren was Toto.
Yeah.
You know, she goes and she pulls back the curtain, and
yeah.
you see the guy behind
the curtain.
It's like
the schlumpy old guy, you know,
basically. Empty shirt.
Ken,
yeah.
Well, it wasn't that he was empty.
No, he's not empty. He was negative. He's sexist and
he's arrogant.
Racist.
He's arrogant. It's
arrogant.
I mean, he was. You could just almost tell. Why did they put me here? Don't they understand I'm Michael Bloomberg?
Yeah.
And I think what's really important is what I've said from the very beginning. We would have a choice in 2020 of two despots. We really would. A destructive despot and an arrogant, benevolent despot. And benevolent based on what his whim du jour is. So if he likes your climate, he'll address your climate. If he doesn't like this climate, he won't. If he likes your city, you might get some help. I mean, that's the problem with Michael Bloomberg, is this isn't about the gestalt. It's about really sort of his personal interests, which is why he wants to personally acquire the presidency. Then the only one he is obligated to is himself.
Although I would point out that he is not such a benevolent dictator when it comes to women. If you happen to be a woman,
yeah.
If you happen to be a person of color, if you happen to be a working person, you know, who doesn't have a palace in Bermuda like he does, you know, benevolent is not the word I would use for him.
Well, I threw an arrow.
I mean,
let's remember, I didn't make him just nice.
And
you know?
One thing that I really loved about watching last night, you know, for all this time in all the debates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been talking about the billionaire class and how they don't represent us average Americans and all the voters who are average Americans. And last night you got to see up close and personal that, this billionaire, this is what the way billionaires think. And
this is how they operate.
This is how they operate. And, yeah, I work hard for all of my billions. Well, everybody in the audience, all the workers in America work hard also, and they don't make billions of dollars.
So I told you that when I went into the voting booth for the New Hampshire primary, that I stood in the voting booth with my number two pencil and I had tears rolling down my cheeks and I did not know who to vote for. I mean, there was anger in me. There was confusion in me. I finally chose, and you know I chose Elizabeth. But let me just say why I chose Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the candidate that I saw, but the woman I saw before she became a candidate. The woman that formed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The woman that taught at Harvard, who wrote the book on finances for regular people.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that woman last night for the first time. I have to be honest with you. I went to hear her with her, I have a plan for this. And I walked away and I watched everybody swept away and I was not swept away. And I'm like, what's wrong with me? And then last night, the woman I finally had penciled in became the woman on the stage, because what Michael Bloomberg stood for was what she has fought against her whole
adult
life.
That's what I was saying. Yeah, exactly.
And it was why they're afraid of her, because she can read a prospectus, because she understands the numbers, because she knows how they're manipulating the economy, because she knows how they're hurting consumers. That was the woman I adore.
Yeah.
And finally she showed up. But I'm just telling you, I'm fighting. Is it too late? That's the only question I have, because that is the biggest fear. But Michael Bloomberg was the best gift to her, because everybody tuned in to watch Michael, and what they got was Elizabeth.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, all the other candidates had the same opportunity that Elizabeth did to go for Michael, who was a pretty easy target, I guess.
Bernie didn't do a very good job. No
Nobody
offense.
Did. Buttigieg didn't. Klobuchar sure didn't. It was really Elizabeth who just right out of the gate tore him apart. And for her, this has been her theme the whole campaign, the disparities between the very wealthy and the rest of us, and we need to make our economy work for all the rest of us, and he ain't it.
All right, so I'm gonna critique her again. And the reason I'm going to critique her again is I hated her ending. I hated it because she had shown such stuff. And then she goes back into Oklahoma and her daddy and whatever. I don't need that anymore. And because in part I wanted her to build on what she had just done with Michael. I wanted her to talk about the fact that, yes, I'm a capitalist, but not a crony capitalist, not a racist capitalist. Yes, I believe in an economy that works, but not for the 1%, but for all of us. I wanted her to take what she had done with Michael, which was so wildly successful. And I wanted to have her stem wonder at the end. Please, please call me. Listen to me, Elizabeth Warren. You know what's wrong. It's not that capitalism doesn't work. It doesn't work when it's bought and sold by rich people who basically benefit them and sacrifice the rest of us. It isn't capitalism. It is an abortion. It is a distortion. It isn't real. And that's the problem with it. Bernie wants to go to democratic socialism. Even the democratic socialist countries believe in capitalism, but their capitalism isn't destructive like ours is. She could have used it as a teachable moment, but she goes into that old sort of campaign rut. Get out of it, Elizabeth. Show up again like you did with Bloomberg. Oh, my God. She was so good.
I think about it from the point of view of someone who's up, like when you are up on a stage and you've got your talking points and whatnot. So you know that when you get to your closing, you can close strong. You've got it prepared and you're just going to do it that way. And the rest of the time you think on your feet.
Yep.
And, you know, she did that great. And, yeah, it'd be wonderful if she was
the
kind of –
she could have learned something from Amy. Because Amy's last debate performance, not this one but the one before, her ending was awesome. Off the charts.
Yeah.
Her ending was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And her ending was really about seeing them. About seeing, remember, it was that story.
Well, that's
about
her campaign speech.
I understand that.
I see you.
But the part of her stump speech is pathetic. That piece is the part that isn't the vibrant Elizabeth. It's the sweet, shine Oklahoma Elizabeth. No, no, I want the fighter Elizabeth. And last night, why did we fall in love with her? Because
the fighter came back. Yeah.
The fighter came back. I'm just telling you, I'm not a consultant, but I'm a fighter.
Well, maybe some of the consultants were wanting her to address the scuttlebutt is anyway that some people don't like her because she's too smart or too condescending or whatever.
She can mention Oklahoma in 37 seconds, less than a second.
She grew up dirt poor and had to fight her way to
education. But that's why
she
grew up dirt poor, but that's why she recognizes the crony capitalism and she calls it out. That's why she recognizes the racist capitalism and she calls it out. Because she knows what it's like to have nothing. And now in the world that she sees, she realizes how they have undermined and enhanced nothing.
Right.
Oh, I'm telling you.
Anyway, it'll be really interesting to see if that carries her to some kind of electoral victory.
Well, we have a guy that's coming on who actually wrote an article that you will love, Ken. And the article was about how the T-Mobile-Sprint merger will increase inequality.
Yeah.
And I read this. First, I saw the headline. And I'm thinking, I want to know about this merger. But the idea that it would increase inequality, at first it didn't compute.
Yeah.
This guy wrote a really, really wonderful piece, and he literally methodically holds your hand and walks you through it. And by the time you're getting done, you are so ticked off because you realize that it's part of the plan. And the plan is not to protect consumers, but to basically protect wealth growth and not in you. In those that ultimately buy, you know, through the mergers and the monopolies, what they're able to do, they're willing to sacrifice you and enhance their basically their profit lines. It's a really great article.
I am going to call.
All right, go grab
him.
And then last but not least, before I grab our guest, I also want to read something else to you. And this is something from Slate.com, everyone. You can tell I like Slate.com. I love TheConversation.com. Please, please, please. If there are certain places I go to all the time, I am going to start with TheConversation.com because it is just a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. It exists in countries all over the world. It brings in PhDs and faculty people who know so much, but they've never really written for a magazine. You know, they write these position papers, but they write things that their students may on occasion read. But they're then forced to write something in a way that is approachable in the vernacular in kind of a magazine format. And all of a sudden you realize, oh, my God, I want that person to teach on my radio waves. I want that person to teach to me in an article that I can read and not have to read his entire textbook. So I'm going to tell you TheConversation.com is fabulous. But the other thing that really is interesting to me is the article at Slate.com about how much can Jeff Bezos' $10 billion do to fight climate change. And I think it's a really important thing to remember that as billionaires talk about their philanthropy, it's not that I don't embrace philanthropy. I want them to be generous with their wealth. But let's factor two things in. How did they make their money? All right. At what sacrifice to the economy and to the rest of us did they make their money? Also realize that when they offer their generosity, their $10 billion, part of that gets written off their tax liability. So his $10 billion contribution will actually drain the federal coffers by $3 billion. And then he gets to choose the climate program he likes and wants, not necessarily the climate program that works for the country and for all of us. So understand that's part of the problem with this, you know, philanthropy of theirs. It's their choice and not necessarily our collective good.
Very important point.
It is such an important point because everyone yells at me and says, oh, you don't want people to be philanthropic? No. That's not what I'm talking about. All right. So let me introduce my guest. We were already waxing poetic about the article that you wrote. It was entitled, How T-Mobile Sprint Merger Will Increase Inequality. So I said, Amit, will you please pronounce your name? Because one, I know I will destroy it. But more importantly, I want to respect you and I want you to share this incredible article with my audience. But I want to make sure that as we approach you, Professor, that we are making sure that people know how to say your name because you are a professor of economics at the Rochester Institute of Technology. You are very smart and very informative. But please, how do you pronounce your name?
Okay, so it's pronounced Amit Batabyal.
Say the last name again.
Batabyal.
Amit, I will definitely be able to say that. So let's walk through this article because what I found so positive about it was that I hadn't looked at the mergers from the perspective of increasing inequality. I knew they offended me. I knew that meant that there'd be less competition. But I also didn't understand what's happened to the whole sort of a monopoly approach and that we've had in America with the Sherman Antitrust Act and all the different acts, and what changed in America to allow these kinds of monopolies to thrive and exist, even though technically on the books they should not. So do a little bit of a history lesson as you then explain why it really does massage inequality in America.
Okay. So the Sherman Act was signed into law in 1890. And the two other laws, federal laws in the United States that are important from an antitrust perspective are the so-called Clayton Act and the Federal Trade Commission Act, both of which became law in 1914.
Wow.
Now, historically, the vigor with which antitrust has been enforced in this country has waxed and waned depending on which administration it is that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So shortly after the enactment of the Sherman Act, around the 1910s, in fact 1911 to be specific, Teddy Roosevelt decided that, you know, he had had enough of the robber barons and that he was going to actually enforce American antitrust laws, and his vigorous enforcement, amongst other things, led to the breakup of John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil. So that was the first instance of using federal antitrust laws in a vigorous way to break up what was obviously a nefarious monopoly from the standpoint of American consumers in general.
Right.
After that, there was a bit of a hiatus with not much happening until his cousin, FDR, became president. FDR became president, and then for a while he did nothing. And then he appointed this really interesting person by the name of Thurman Arnold from Wyoming, who was also a professor of law at Yale Law School for a while. Mm-hmm. But Thurman Arnold had certain unique talents for selling whatever it is he thought was worth selling. And one of the key things that he was selling is the idea that American corporations in general are too large, they're too powerful, and they typically have consumer interest last on their mind in terms of their daily activities.
Does he have children? Can I marry them? I'm sorry.
I don't know.
All right, so keep going.
Okay, so Thurman Arnold vigorously enforced antitrust laws in every way, shape, or form that he could.
Oh,
he brought legal action against so many different companies and groups and won a notable victory against the American Medical Association, which I described briefly in the article.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, he really scared a lot of American companies because they knew that if he thought anything at all was nefarious in the way in which they were functioning, particularly inimical to consumer interests, then he would go after them with everything he had at his disposal. So 1930s, late 1930s, early 1940s was the heyday of antitrust enforcement, with the administration of the time vigorously looking into consumer interests. Now, because these things tend to wax and wane, gradually, as the University of Chicago's free market thinking, primarily in its economics department, but also in its law school, began to, you know, get the upper hand in terms
infiltrate.
Of how economics should be structured,
yeah, right,
and what the role of firms, and in particular the role of the government, is. The University of Chicago has this very free market style. They believe that government is often the problem and not the solution, and that if we only left highly efficient firms to do whatever it is that they wanted, then everybody in the American economy would prosper. You know, like a version of what's good for Ford is good for America,
right,
or what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Right.
But that was clearly not true. But unfortunately, you had some very good salesmen for this particular perspective. And the person who comes to mind chiefly in this regard is Robert Bork.
Bork, exactly, Bork.
Yes,
right.
The failed Supreme Court nominee, of course, many years later.
What about
but
Milton
he
Friedman?
Espoused this view that the only thing that matters is economic efficiency. Everything else is secondary. So government should do the least amount of stuff that it possibly can, because it generally creates more problems than it solves. And we should look at efficiency. Are firms operating efficiently? Are there impediments to efficiency? And if there are, what can we do to make sure that we get rid of these impediments so that economic efficiency looms large?
So, Ahmed, let me just stop you here, because I did write this down. I wrote what we went from a perspective with FDR and his cousin from consumer welfare to economic efficiency. So let me just ask the question, and I'm not from the Chicago school, but isn't there an argument that if companies are efficient, that therefore they will be able to produce or distribute a product at a more affordable cost, that they will not be encumbered by things that will add to the ultimate charge that they will be making to the consumer. So in a way, economic efficiency is really good for consumer welfare. Isn't that part of the argument? And if it isn't part of the argument, then explain to me why the two seem to be very different paths when it comes to how we look at corporate concentration.
Okay, so let me try to explain that with a relatively simple example.
Okay.
So in our free enterprise capitalist system, the business of firms typically is to maximize profits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they exist to make their profits as large as possible. So you could make the argument that if any firm is attempting to maximize profits, but at the same time not doing anything illegal, then it's doing what is best for itself. And by doing what is best for itself, maximizing profits, the chances are it's doing also what is good for consumers.
Right.
Why? Because of some of the points that you just mentioned, providing a wide array of goods and services at presumably the lowest cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is true if the underlying market structure is competitive. But if the underlying market structure is not competitive, but, say, oligopolistic, which means a small number of large firms are competing amongst themselves, or, worse, monopolistic, that means one firm basically comprises the industry, then this efficiency argument falls flat.
Right.
It's no longer true that what firms are doing when they're maximizing profits in a non-competitive market structure will also lead to the welfare of consumers.
So, you know, give me an example.
Go ahead.
Go on. No, so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the argument behind the Trump tax cuts, where he gave an enormous tax cut, just not to the wealthy, but to corporations. It was like a tax cut wet dream. They never imagined that they would see their tax burden reduced so low. And one of the arguments was, well, the reason we're doing this is that obviously with this additional cash, they'll make additional capital investments, that they will actually pay their employees more, that they will expand their operations. And what we saw was the exact opposite. And if you focus in on the kind of consolidation that's occurred before the tax cuts, then you're absolutely right. Economic efficiency basically went, all that money went into profits and investments in their shareholders or buybacks, and that was enhancing their bottom line, and the consumer be damned.
That is generally true, and I'll add one more thing to it. All of these activities that were supposed to happen miraculously as a result of the large Trump tax cuts not only has been shown to be untrue, But the empirical evidence is that many large firms, instead of hiring more or paying their workers more, are basically hoarding cash and sitting on this particular cash and not paying their workers or improving the healthcare plans that they provide their workers. So it's one thing to say, as an economist, I get when an argument sounds good in principle. Mm-hmm. But when those sets of policies are actually put in place, then you have to look at the data to see what has actually emerged. And the data, or more generally the empirical evidence, runs contrary to the claims that if we provide these kinds of tax cuts, all manner of good things will happen, not the least to consumers. Because that's just not true.
Could I just say something? This theory, the laissez-faire free market theory of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, really only works if certain assumptions are met, and the assumptions are not related to the real world. The assumptions are that there are perfect markets, that there's perfect information, that everybody has access to all the relevant information, consumers and workers and capitalists, that there's no racial discrimination, no gender discrimination. And in terms of the most efficient corporations prevailing in the free market, you have to have no barriers to entry. So if you've got a few large companies dominating an industry, it's very hard, very expensive. Most people don't have the money, don't have the loans from banks to be able to break into the market. So there's all these. And then also the maximize your profits for your shareholders doesn't take account of internalizing the costs of externalities, which means if the corporations have to pay their workers or pay for machines, they pay those costs. But if the corporation also pollutes the river downstream, the corporation doesn't have to pay for that because that's an external effect. And unless the government forces them to pay for all the costs of their operation, then it's not a perfect market.
And Amit, the reason why they don't have to pay for the pollution is because as they get richer and richer, they buy the lobbyists, they pay for the congressmen, they do whatever.
Right.
So the rules and regulations now benefit them as opposed to benefiting the consumers and the American good. I mean, it is social. So I got to ask you a question, Amit. Why hasn't any of the candidates running for president do exactly what you just did on this radio show and talk about what happened with the 2017 tax cuts and talked about what happened with that? Because if nothing else, that just points out that there are cuts and there are cuts. And the cuts that we saw here was about accumulating wealth for the very wealthy and for corporate America. It wasn't about investing in us. So this is like, it's like flawed and failed on steroids.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, each of the Democratic political candidate, presidential candidates are making strategic choices in terms of what they believe is going to get them the greatest number of votes and delegates, depending on where they currently are.
Right.
So they're talking about big-ticket items like health care, which is important. But this stuff is also important.
Yes.
And inequality is a theme that people have talked about a lot. I mean, for instance, Bernie Sanders talks about that all the time, the difference between the wealth that the very top of the American population has accumulated and the bottom, say, even 50% who have so little. I mean, he's on record for having said that billionaires shouldn't exist.
I
think he said that yesterday to
again.
Mike Bloomberg to his face. So people are talking about that.
But maybe
not with as much vigor as you would like them to.
Well, no. I want to. So you talked a little bit about the effect of the mergers and why it has a negative impact for consumers. It may be good for efficiency. Share with my audience before I have to let you go, which I wish I could have kept you on for an hour, is talk about the Affordable Care Act and what happened as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Because, I mean, the Bernies and the Elizabeths are saying the Affordable Care Act is not nirvana. There are problems with it. We need to more than just tweak it. We need to really sort of change the system. Let the audience know what happened with the Affordable Care Act. They have no idea.
Well, the Affordable Care Act has certain positives.
Yes.
I'm not going to slam it.
Expansion of Medicaid, a government program, is one of the best parts of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, it brought large numbers of people within the group of those who are insured, and it forced certain people, forced in quotes, to pay a penalty if they did not, in fact, want to be insured, because you want a generally broad pool of people,
right,
some of whom are very healthy, others are not so, and then relatively sick people, in order to make insurance a reasonable proposition. But what ended up happening, and this is the
incredible
point that I made in my article, is that you did see in the aftermath of the Affordable Care Act a bunch of consolidations of hospitals, both for-profit and non-for-profit. And once these consolidations of hospitals occur, and of course hospital management would tell you things like, oh, we're doing this for greater efficiencies, so they themselves typically cannot define what that actually means. The result, again, the empirical evidence is that we have seen cost increases for consumers post-consolidation. And that is the important thing, for instance, to keep in mind in the context of this T-Mobile-Sprint merger. I've had several people write to me and tell me, hey, I have a great plan with T-Mobile. I get this, that, blah, blah, blah. So why are you complaining about this particular merger? And, you know, my response is, A, the history with mergers, when four firms become three or three becomes two, the history with these mergers is that it almost always is worse for consumers. Moreover, if you like your plan, just wait.
Yeah.
Wait a while and see what happens.
Exactly.
If a year from now you're still as excited, then maybe things aren't quite bad. But there is nothing to prevent the combined entity from raising prices.
Amit, you are phenomenal. You're a great teacher. You're a wonderful writer. TheConversation.com should have you do it like all the time. How the T-Mobile Sprint merger will increase inequality. Read this and you will understand why there are people like Elizabeth Warren who wants to stand up there and really sort of take on corporate America. These mergers lead to crony capitalism. These mergers lead to buying not just what's happening in Congress, but maybe even buying the White House. And in the end, I keep asking my audience over and over again, Amit, what is an economy for if it only benefits the 1%? And if the rest of us are struggling and seeing prices increase and seeing our healthcare getting more and more, you know, out of affordability range and looking at what's happening as a result of climate change, you have to ask, things need to change because this is not an economy that actually serves our well-being. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I think I want to go to school at the Rochester Institute of Technology. to sit
you.
At your feet. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone. We're going to do a little labor history. That's next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day the National Lawyers Guild held their first convention in the nation's capital. The guild was established as a way to bring together progressive lawyers dedicated to fighting for basic and progressive change in our political and economic system and to assure that human rights be regarded as more sacred than property interests. Members were admitted regardless of race, sex, or political beliefs. The early Guild stood up for FDR's New Deal reforms like a full Social Security program against the staunch opposition of the American Bar Association. From its inception, protecting the rights of working people has been an important effort for the Guild. At the first convention, they passed a resolution supporting the rights of working people to organize and collectively bargain. Guild lawyers supported the founding of both the United Auto Workers and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. They also stood up for civil rights, adopting an anti-lynching resolution at their first convention. During the civil rights era, they provided legal aid for activists and fought for voting rights. This made them a target during the 1950s Cold War anti-communist hysteria. The FBI targeted the Guild for investigation. By 1955, the Guild had dropped to just 500 members. In the 1970s, the Guild successfully sued to find out the extent of FBI spying. They discovered that 1,000 informants had generated FBI files of 400,000 pages on the Guild and its members. Despite this harassment, the Guild has kept up its fight for working people. The organization has opposed anti-worker legislation from Taft-Hartley to the passage of NAFTA. In 2012, the Guild celebrated its 75th anniversary stronger than ever.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Concrete and asphalt absorb the sun's energy. So when a heat wave strikes, city neighborhoods with few trees and lots of black pavement can get hotter than other areas. A lot hotter.
15, 18 degrees Fahrenheit difference across a city at the same time.
Vivek Chandis of Portland State University leads a heat mapping project funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Over the last few summers, the project partnered with local groups in Washington, D.C., Portland, Oregon, Boston, and other cities. Volunteers use cars equipped with sensors that gather temperature and humidity data. Shondas and his team used that data to create digital maps showing how temperatures vary block by block. The hottest areas are often low-income, underserved neighborhoods. Shondas says getting residents involved in collecting data can help inspire local solutions. For example, people may initiate tree planting projects targeted at the neighborhoods that need them most.
The partnerships have been really instrumental in being able to get the communities together, to convene them, to go out and do this campaign, and then to come back and start interpreting what it is that they're seeing and ultimately what it is they can do about it.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. Baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not a little boy. If you are serious, don't play with my heart, it makes me furious. But if you want me to love you, then a baby, I'll wait. Girl, you know I will. Tell it like it is.
This is the Attitude Authority Artisan and Ken Barnes. I know who this song is dedicated to. She did it last night, Elizabeth Warren. She told it like it is.
Yeah. This is Aaron Neville, by the way, saying Tell It Like It Is. And
I'm always trying to figure what code you're sending me, you know. You speak in code like Donald Trump. I know. Warren.
Well, but not just Warren, but everybody told Bloomberg
like it is
that the emperor has no clothes.
Well, the only thing I'm so shocked about is that how he seems so unprepared. And for someone who had time, money, consultants, educators, I mean, they could have given him little crib sheets to be able to respond. I mean, I wouldn't have minded if he read it. But the fact that he looked like a deer in the headlight, unbelievable. Mm. Well, joining us right now is someone who will also give us analysis of last night's debate, where finally the billionaire showed up. We have on the air Bill Curry. Bill Curry writes for Salon.com, was a two-time nominee for governor in Connecticut, was an advisor to President Bill Clinton, has been engaged in progressive politics forever, since in utero, I suspect. So let me welcome Bill to the program. And maybe give me – this is going to be awesome. Awful. But if you had one word for last night's debate, is there a word? Is there a word that you would use?
Counterproductive.
Oh, good. Ooh. I want to hear this. Okay, so let me hear. Counterproductive. This is why you're so enlightening. I just love you. All right, keep going.
You know, I mean, first of all, no one, at least of all me, can sort out all the, you know, collateral consequences of what happened.
Right.
You know, did it, in fact, by... Did the dismantling of Michael Bloomberg elevate the chances of Joe Biden? I don't know. Did Elizabeth Warren's feisty, aggressive performance elevate her chances of winning in Nevada or thereafter? I honestly don't know. I do think that Warren really did destroy Bloomberg. They all participated, but she, of course, was the principal person doing it. The problem is that in being so negative, you can sometimes damage yourself at the same time. I think that if she'd been a little less critical of everyone else on the stage, if she'd managed to keep participating without going after any other candidates, but just focused on Bloomberg, I think it would have been a better strategy for her. That's what I would have told her to do going in.
So you mean, her comment about the Post-it note with Amy was harmful and not necessary. I mean, you know, we already know that Amy's going to massage whatever the status quo is. And I mean, and so what she was trying to do was critique Pete and Amy, but it came out a little bit harsher than necessary.
It did. And again, the talking about hate speech for Bernie's people is almost as bad as Chuck Todd talking about brown shirters. There have been many moments when she said that if Bernie raised the question of whether a woman was electable, which I don't really believe he would do, especially in a conversation with her, we've never had an exact quote from that conversation, or alleged quote. I think that she hurt herself when she did that as well. And so there's a piece about this. I mean, they all Pete Buttigieg is the absolute master of sticking in the shiv without seeming to.
We were just saying that during the break. That's so funny. We're like, he is so gifted. I don't want to be in a dark room with him. Oh, my God. You're right. You're right.
It really is amazing.
It is amazing.
And all of them. You know, it strikes me just stepping back. So, first of all, I know it asks a lot. And especially when everybody on the stage realizes that they could be one debate away from extinction. And that focuses everybody's mind. It makes everybody a little bit more negative. All their staffs told them to go out and throw their best punches, and so they did. I think that there's a better way to compete. I think that the person who can be as unsparing with the facts and fierce logic as possible, but who is as restrained and civil in tone and language as possible, that's the winning combo. It's not that you let anybody up off the mat when you've got them, but that you realize that the way to get them is by the power of reason and the power of value.
Let me just stop you here for one quick second, Bill. We just interviewed a professor from the Rochester Institute of Technology, and he wrote a piece about mergers. But here's a little nugget of information he shared with us, which I wish someone like an Elizabeth or a Bernie had shared last night. He talked about the fact that after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we saw a significant number of hospital mergers. And because of the hospital mergers, not only have we seen the demise of rural hospitals all over the country, and we've seen that literally happening everywhere, but as a result of the mergers, the consolidation meant that costs went up by 20%. So in a way, it's a way of saying the Affordable Care Act doesn't need to be tweaked. Look at the damage, even as it did some good things. Look at what it did to costs and affordability. And even if you have insurance, if it costs more to get to the hospital and you have a deductible or you have a copay, you are making a decision whether you can afford to do it even with insurance. So this is the problem with the Affordable Care Act. And I think, in a way, those numbers are powerful because it suddenly means I'm not saying I don't like it, but look at the result.
Yeah, and it's also, again, Bernie is the person in this field who's closest to my own view of the world. And he also, by the way, as was finally pointed out on television for the first time that I ever heard, the most popular person in the field. He's the person whom Democrats like the most personally, by a lot. The numbers in the NBC poll were 72 favorable, 19 unfavorable.
Wow.
It blows everyone away. And it also blows away the idea that he's an intrinsically divisive figure. He's also the most popular person in general election polling, and he's been the most popular political figure in America for five consecutive years.
Yeah,
where he
amazing.
Isn't popular is on cable television, in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and in all those elite media institutions that are aligned with the donor class of the Democratic Party. They're not aligned purposefully. They're not aligned conspiratorially. They're simply aligned intellectually. And it serves their interests because they all work for big corporations.
Yeah. Well, it's Stephanie Ruhle. It's Stephanie Ruhle, who worked for Bloomberg News for almost 15 years, running his TV operation, being one of his senior editors. And she is commenting on Bloomberg, and she's sitting on the set of MSNBC. And someone said, oh, well, she's told us once in a while that she had a relationship with Bloomberg News. I said, one, she should say it every time. And two, she should be removed from that chair. She now has a grotesque conflict. And yet that's true of almost everyone on the MSNBC set.
Yeah, I mean, on the entire CNN panel last night and most nights, almost every night, the only person that comes close to treating Sanders fairly is Van Jones.
Yeah.
And he only does it episodically. And on MSNBC, except when they have an actual Sanders representative, there's no one.
Yeah.
And MSNBC is a liberal's favorite media outlet.
Well,
but it shares an ideology. It believes, again, centrist ideology is the hardest ideology to identify, to call out.
Right.
It does the best job of masquerading as science and logic. But, you know, they just miss so many things, including, for instance, on Sanders, all of the data.
Yeah.
All of the data says that he's probably the strongest candidate. All of our presuppositions about it, mean that he isn't. And by the way, the Republicans have done almost nothing to tag Sanders in all 5 years, but our own allies have tagged him relentlessly.
You're absolutely right, which I have gone apoplectic on so many occasions in the show, I can't even tell you. Again, I'm going to use the line that I heard the other day that it still is staggering to me. Bernie had the poll numbers came in 31%. It was ahead of everyone by double digits. And the way they framed it was Bernie has flatlined at number one.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to hear this because, and I'm going to use it over and on, and that's just a tiny example of what they are doing. And I think that's part of the problem. And the only time now that they revel in covering him is when his passionate supporters, who they now label as Bernie Bros, who've done some outrageous things, don't get me wrong, they not only love it, they highlight it, they make it every person who supports Bernie, and on top of which, they throw more gasoline on top of them and keep throwing matches because the way they unfairly treat him, comparing him to Fidel Castro, referring to what he will do to this country, which is so wrong, and never include him in any real conversation. They don't invite Bernie on. They never do, and that's intentional. You know, as they genuflected and kissed Donald Trump's you-know-what, look what they're doing with Bernie. They're trying to isolate, and in some ways the isolation has actually almost enhanced his stature.
I think in some ways that it actually has thus far. And I don't know, though, what the long-term effect is going to be.
Yeah.
I do know that far more than the trolls online, that the work of all the major media corporations and the party itself have made it harder for the Democrats to win, whether we nominate someone from the establishment or we nominate Bernie or Elizabeth. She's still, you know,
yeah,
and I still regard her as, you know, significantly more progressive than the rest of the field. That either way, they're making it harder. The Bernie people listen to this. They know, again, the Bernie Bros thing, people should understand this. Let me just use this to clarify
okay.
for people. I've researched this. I've looked at it hard. There, when Bernie says that there is just as much flack going his way as going at the others, that looks to me to be just about correct. When he says that he has no control over it, that is correct. Something I mentioned to Ken talking before the show, in 2016, Hillary's campaign, with the odious David Brock, ran a secret online operation
Thank
in which
you.
He spent mm-hmm. at least $1 million smearing people who supported Bernie, I might have been one, and Bernie himself. Mm. And then part of that smear was to spread the Bernie Bro meme, mm-hmm. which they created. This was created in Hillary's shop because, and you see this all the time in establishment media, they want to conflate progressive economic populism with regressive cultural populism, so-called, with which it has nothing in common.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying that the United Auto Workers and the Ku Klux Klan are the same thing. Okay?
But actually, can I just say something? Bloomberg
yep.
did say that. Bloomberg compared the civil libertarians and the teachers' unions to the NRA. Do you know that? He said that.
Yes.
I mean, so
he
is awful. But I'm just saying what you just said is actually, you know, intensified with Bloomberg.
It happens all the time.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, it happens in some form every night on cable television, every other day in the New York Times, every other day in the Washington Post. And ceaselessly, as we learned from those pilfered emails of the DNC, all the time in the Democratic hierarchy. Now, I believe that either way this goes, there's a problem that has to be solved, and it's a problem in each case that neither side wants to hear about. What we've been discussing is an exact rerun of what happened in 2016,
exactly.
with the Democratic Party. Did rig the Iowa caucuses, did rig the Nevada caucuses, did unilaterally, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, cancel all the debates and put the remaining ones on weekends so that no one could hear them. These were atrocious infringements on due process, and there were many, many more. And what they did was they left a very, very, angry and sullen feeling among many Bernie supporters. When they won the nomination, they revealed that they treat the progressive base of the party as nothing more than a speed bump. That once they've gotten over it, then they can just, you know, motor the car. They just, you know, drive on and leave it behind, as opposed to consolidate it. Hillary Clinton made zero attempts to consolidate a progressive base, which she scorned. Mm-hmm. And that's why she lost. I mean, she lost. She was also cheated by Comey and Putin and the Electoral College. And I know there's sexism, but if she'd taken any of Bernie's message of economic populism and political reform and put it into any of her ads and her stump speech, I think she'd have taken those three states we lost by 100,000.
But you know that I was looking at Wisconsin, and this is the part, this is the tragedy of Wisconsin. So people keep saying, oh, it's the Bernie people that voted for Donald Trump. It's the people that didn't show up. Here is the amazing story of Wisconsin. There's always a group of people that go in and vote, but they don't necessarily vote for president. They may vote for everyone other than president, but they don't always check off the box. And I think maybe 4 years before, when it was actually Barack Obama, with a sense of maybe disappointment in Barack, about 40,000 people in Wisconsin did not vote for Barack Obama. That number doubled in 2016. So you actually got people that walked into a voting booth, and 40,000 more than 4 years before chose neither Trump or Hillary Clinton. And what did she lose Wisconsin by? So if you are going to blame Bernie Sanders, it's a come to Jesus moment, everyone. You better do what you do, Bill Curry, and what I started to do, which is actually look at the real numbers that show the true story, so we don't sort of, we're not in la-la land lying to ourselves about what happened. Because if you lie to yourself, you can't fix it, Bill.
I believe that there are two great dangers here, one of which is that we nominate one of the centrist candidates, so-called, and that person leaves behind the message of economic populism and, above all, political reform. And by the way, thirdly, doesn't have enough to say about climate change.
Right.
And at the same time, I began writing a piece this morning that there are basically two factions in the Democratic Party, the progressive base and the establishment center, and the danger is that one of them will win. and the progressive base has to look into its weaknesses. It bothers me. I worry that we're going to have to explain the real meaning of democratic socialism and defeat Donald Trump in the same year. I am unnerved by that.
So how do we do that?
Well, let me just say, to me, being a progressive, it means understanding that the rules affecting the distribution of income, wealth, power, and opportunity are skewed, terribly skewed, in favor of the already wealthy and powerful, and that the democracy is corrupt. And on those issues, we should not flinch. We should not compromise. Compromise our opinions, but not our convictions, and those are our convictions. We also shouldn't compromise on climate change. On everything else, we should be aware of the following, and that is that we don't want to compromise with the insurance industry. We don't have to. We don't have to compromise with the pharmaceutical industry or with the military-industrial complex. We do have to compromise with the voters.
Yes.
And the voters have a set of somewhat more conservative questions that are legitimate. They include, how much will that cost?
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two, how will it actually work?
Mm-hmm.
And number three, by the way, unrelated to the first two, will you keep me safe?
Yes, exactly.
And when we decry the exorbitant military budget, we always forget to explain that, in fact, we are safer under the rule of law than by the force, made safer by the rule of law than the force of arms.
Right.
We stop short of explaining the critique and helping people to understand what the changes are we need to make to become safer. And when we put programs on the table, as a progressive, I think that the fiscal bidding war between Bernie and Elizabeth has been the wrong way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And people do want big, bold change. It doesn't mean that they want big bureaucracies. The problem with Medicare for All is that we're telling people we're going to put them into a system we haven't built yet. There has to be more respect for that anxiety.
I totally agree with you.
And for how we're going to get there.
And AOC said that.
The possibility, and my greatest reservation about Bernie is that there is a certain inflexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in my heart, there's never been somebody on these key issues that I felt, so clearly and strongly expressed my views running for president. But those two pieces. The danger here is that an establishment donor class Democrat wins and scuttles the populism and the reform of corruption because they don't really believe in it or understand it, and no one else other than Warren and Sanders on that stage do understand the real meaning of corruption or how to fight it. Period.
So why?
And the other danger is that we don't fix the, on the progressive side, the things I just talked about. Go ahead.
So actually what you just said, I said on the radio this morning in Tampa, Florida, exactly what you just said about Bernie and about the inflexibility and about the fact that we haven't built it yet. All those things, it's just spooky to me. But one of the things that I kept screaming at the TV set is that, you know, Bernie talks about the democratic socialism and he gets into that label. And yet, as you said, 70% of folks support him. They've been able to distinguish between whatever the socialism boogie monster that people keep throwing out and Bernie because they like what Bernie's talking about. Yeah, I want to be able to go to a doctor when I'm sick. Yeah, I want to earn $15 an hour. Yeah, I don't want my kid to, like, go into debt. I mean, so they're going, well, is that socialism? Maybe it's not so bad because whatever Bernie's saying, I want a piece of that, okay? So they absolutely do that. But the other thing is that when Bernie refers to his models for socialism and they throw up, you know, communist Russia or Venezuela, they throw up something to scare everyone, he always turns to Finland and Denmark and Sweden. Mm-hmm. And you know what's so amazing to me, and I haven't heard Elizabeth say this, let's define what the Nordic model is. And if you look up, everyone, the Nordic model, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, all those countries, it is capitalist. It is a form of capitalism called compassionate capitalism. They also have a strong safety net. People are happier. People are all taken care of because they're able to tether the crony capitalism that now we're stuck with and making a capitalism that not only works, but it thrives. And that, I think, is the problem, is that we've gotten into these labels and no one has been able to define what we have now.
Let me just say this. Defining those labels has been a lifetime pursuit for many people, and nobody's figured it out yet. The word conservative, who knows what that means? Liberal, who knows what that means? Socialist, populist, what do any of these words mean? And I would argue, I'd make a counter-argument, and that is that the job of the Democratic nominee is to take this down from the level of abstraction to the level of concreteness and specificity.
And that's
exactly.
And that's the way of defining it. But the danger is here, again, I wish that we could make the 2020 project defeating Trump and then make the 2021 project explaining the real meaning of democratic socialism.
Or the real meaning of capitalism and the compassionate capitalism. Because let me just say something. I think that you're exactly right that we need to take it down from abstract to concrete. And the only people that are making the labeling concrete are the conservatives who say that Bernie's ideas are equivalent to Stalin's or Cuba's. But the Nordic example, last night when Pete Buttigieg, I think it was, said that Bernie's ideas are like Denmark, or maybe that Buttigieg liked the Denmark proposal, and Bernie said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about with my healthcare plan. I mean, that's kind of a concrete way of looking at it. We need something, maybe it's not Denmark, but certainly something that is more concrete than letting them set him up like he's a communist.
But is part of the problem with Bernie, and I'm going to go back to what I said in 2017. I didn't want Bernie and Biden to run. I don't want to relitigate 2016. And frankly, I don't want to be stuck in his labels. I don't want to hear Democratic Socialists go up and down the flagpole 47,000 times a day. And the proof of it is what you just said with the numbers. 70% of people support Bernie. They're not sure they support socialism, but what they hear from Bernie are the policies you were just talking about.
Right. Think of every time let me just say two things. One, think of every time you hear Trump brag about all the regulations, the job-killing regulations that he's revoked. And now ask yourself how many times you've seen a Democrat on television explaining what those regulations are and why they will cause more, why their repeal will cause more children to die and why their repeal threatens the planet. Yeah. Telling people exactly which regulations allowing toxic chemicals to be leached into rivers from mining sites and on and on and on. If you make the deregulation fight with Trump specific, he loses.
Exactly.
We don't need to convince anybody. 70% of the country's already with us. That's all we need to do. On Medicare for All, I wish Bernie were a little more nimble afoot. The question here is how do you bring the cost down? for small businesses, for families, for governments, for everybody. He gets close to it. And how can we make this a more reasoned argument? The problem is not just the greed of insurers. It is not a question of the ill character of anyone in the system. The system we have is terribly wasteful.
Yeah.
Just for you can't have. It is not true that every country in the world has a single payer.
I know.
But it is true that no other country in the world has a for-profit insurance industry. None of them. If they have insurance industries, they're non-profit.
Write that column.
Okay?
I need to let you go. Bill Curry, I need to let you go. I want you on for an hour as well. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, it is about the policies. It's not about the labels. You know, a label doesn't change my life. A policy does. Exactly. Mazel tov. Thank you so much.
Now.
All right, ciao. Thank you so much, Mr. Curry. Bye-bye. Yeah. All right, everyone, we're going to end with.
Apologies to Bill Curry. He was talking about Bernie so much, but this is Put a Woman in Charge. Kev Mo.
That's right. We've had a lot of men.
And,
let's see.
Yeah. I love Elizabeth Warren, Amy
well
Klobuchar.
Yeah. She did level.
Way back when, in the beginning of time, man made the fire, then the went from a horse to an automobile. He said the world is mine. He took the oceans and the sky. He set the borders, built the walls. He won't stop till he owns it all. And here we are, standing on the brink of disaster. Enough is enough. I know the answer. Put a woman in charge. Put the woman in charge. Put a woman in charge. Put the woman in charge. The time has come. We've got to turn this world around. Call the mothers, call the daughters. We need the sisters of mercy now. She'll be a hero, not a fool. She's got the power to change the rules. She's got something men don't have. She is kind and she understands.